Welcome to This Complex Life, a podcast where we explore the intricacies of wellbeing and relationships. I'm your host, Marie Vakakis, an accredited mental health social worker, family therapist, speaker, and mental health educator. Coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri people, join me as we demystify mental health, break down stigma, and navigate life's messiness and complexities one conversation at a time. And just a little reminder, information in this podcast is for educational purposes only. Anything said should not be taken as a replacement for medical, clinical, or other professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. This podcast is not a substitute for professional mental health treatment and advice. If you or someone you know requires support, please contact a mental health professional in your area. Thanks for listening. How we feel impacts what we eat. In today's interview, I chat with Dr. Lucy Barnes about our mood and food and how those two are related, how what we feel impacts what we eat. And sometimes what we eat can impact how we feel, and that cycle can go round and round. I hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Lucy. Hello and welcome to This Complex Life. Today I have a very special guest, Dr. Lucy. Welcome to the show, Lucy.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Marie. It's an absolute honour to be invited on.
Could you share with listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do?
Absolutely. So my title as a doctor possibly gives it a little bit away. So yeah, I'm a medical practitioner. And it's interesting. So I used to sort of introduce myself as, I'm a weight management doctor, which never sat really well with me. It was like something I sort of felt like, oh, yay. So I now describe, I guess, what we do. And so I run a business and we help women who have basically tried every diet under the sun, always looking for weight loss. But for us, it's about helping them optimize their health and manage their mindset so that they can live, you know, lives full of joy and energy and free of chronic disease and live a life when they're not sitting on the sidelines because of health related issues. So, you know, for us, that's really what we embody. And, you know, yeah, sometimes some weight loss is required for that to happen, but that's not the only, like, that's not the focus.
Yeah. So by we, you mean you and Dr. Mary?
Yes. Yes. So I have a gorgeous business partner called Dr. Mary, who is like the yin to my yang. And the two of us run a business called Real Life Medicine. And for us, our name actually just says it all. Like, honestly, that is the things that we try and embody are things that are helpful in real life, because we're not all, you know, athletes with teams of cooks or chefs or trainers or, you know, supermodels with, you know, everything scheduled out for them, and they just have to step out of a room. Where both of us are real life people with other, you know, jobs, kids, partners, parents, all the needs that standard real life people have.
Yeah. And that's sort of the focus of what we want to talk about today is the life stuff. So if someone's listening, yeah, hoping to get like your top five diet tips or what to eat or what not to eat, we're not really going there. But starting off, how do you describe the relationship between our mindset and eating habits? And I know from listening to your podcast and even doing one of the courses myself, you spend a lot of time focusing on the psychology of eating.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, and I'm sure all your listeners will know, the thing is that, you know, dieting has set us up to follow a rule or a plan or count points or come up with some formula. And most of us can do that when everything is fine, when life is going along really well. But then what happens when life throws a curveball, or we go on holidays, or we're out of our routine? We've been actually disempowered by the diet industry because we don't know what to do. So it's like, and I reckon one of the most common questions we get asked is this allowed, or can I eat this? Or it's like this permission. And it's because we don't know what to do anymore. And it's fascinating. And I get it, because I did exactly the same as the diet queen. I counted points, I watched portions, I added up serving sizes of things and weighing and measuring. So of course I had no idea about actually what my intuition or what my body needed. I had no idea how to work that out. So one of our things is looking at, not just what we eat, but why we eat. And when you can understand why you eat, then that's like that's the biggest piece of the puzzle.
There's an old saying, I don't know if it's old and I don't know who said it, but anyway, that it's not so much, when you're looking at health outcomes, and there was a really big study that came out that tracked the health outcomes over multiple decades, and it's the quality of our relationships that really impacted the quality of life. So there's also this thing of it's not always just what you eat, it's who you eat with as well. How do you make sense of that with what you've just described? Like, if you're counting calories, you're following rules, you're doing all this stuff, how do we include connection in that?
So, and it's interesting because food is a very integral part of people's lives. I mean, we do it several times a day, and we usually often do it with people. And I guess there's a couple of ways that we look at things, and this is the nuance I think that needs to be spoken more about, is navigating, extremes. So there are processed food companies in particular that are hijacking the food is love message and food is connection. And when you think about the ads on telly, their KFC ads are all, give mum the day off, and they're all sitting around having a beautiful barbecue with lovely, place settings, and someone brings along the bucket of KFC and everyone's hurrah. And it's like, that is so different to preparing a, or it, and again, I'm not a cook. I don't cook a lot of, I don't like cooking. I eat beautiful, real food, but I'm not one of those people that really gets their thrills out of cooking. But I'm very happy to bang a slow cooked something or other in the slow cooker and pull it out, and it's delicious still. So working out the messaging and who's driving that messaging is really important because, newsflash, processed food companies do not care about your health. They do not care about anything other than their profits. And so they will use whatever sneaky marketing tactics that play on our heartstrings to get you to buy their product. And my biggest bugbear is our society has this disconnect with that concept and then blames the individual for being overweight or developing obesity or chronic obesity related diseases, and says, well, they just should eat better. And it's like, oh, it's so much more complicated than that. And so when I'm calling out processed food companies, it's never about the individual, because the individual is actually the victim. The company's driving this message, they're the perpetrators, and they take no responsibility for it at all.
Yeah, that's a really powerful message.
Yeah. So again, we can reclaim our power though, because nobody wants to be a victim. You don't need to be a victim. But what, so whenever people go, oh, Lucy, you're so strict. I'm not, like, honestly, I'm not. I'm not perfect. I'm not, plucking my own spinach from the garden every day or anything like that. But what I am now is really mindful of the choices that I'm making for me, and not so much for my family now because my kids are adult, young adults, but certainly growing up. And there's stuff that I now know that I wish I'd known when they were little. I didn't know. And so, I used to do all the things that people, busy mums do. I'd buy takeaway pizzas from Aldi that had goat cheese and beetroot and think, oh, they're good. Not having any idea about the processing that's involved and the reason that processed food hijacks everything, all of our intuition around what we need as humans to eat.
Yeah. So if we look at, you mentioned sort of understanding about yourself and the things you wish you knew. How do we relate that to our mental state? So how does how we feel or our well-being impact what we eat or our nutrition?
Yeah. So it's a two-way street. So our brain and our body are obviously connected. Like, we know that, you know that on one level, but interestingly, medicine in particular separates them out. You know, there's mental and psychological health over here and physical health over here, but they're the same thing. So there's a it's a two-way street. So what we eat can impact our mood, and our mood impacts what we eat. So there's no doubt that when you're, you know, stressed, tired, emotional, whatever that means, whether that's angry, lonely, sad, guilty, resentful, ashamed, any of those things, we can use food or food products, as I now like to call them, to as an attempt to make ourselves feel better. And again, it's a tool, and it works. I mean, if it didn't work, we wouldn't do it. So people, when they feel sad, will eat chocolate, and it does make you feel better short term. And it's designed to do that. And we're then encouraged again through repetitive commercialization of a thing that we did initially, potentially innocently, but that message is just reinforced over and over again. So one of the things that we love teaching, I guess, is the idea that human emotions, and I mean, you know this more than anyone, Maria, are complex. We often have to feel them. We don't want to feel them. We don't like feeling them. So we all push them away, shovel them down in whatever way we can. And in particular, processed food and if you're an adult, alcohol, you know, they're really cheap and effective ways to do that. But they come at a cost long term. They don't come at, you know, short term again. Nobody develops alcohol-related diseases, you know, having had one glass of wine after work on a stressful day. But if you do that every day and that amount increases after 20 years, you do.
Yeah. So stress is a big one. And I think some of those feelings you mentioned are usually around stressful either events or situations or not getting your own way. Like they're all sort of effects of experiences. And stress is common. People are busy, they're time poor. How does when we're stra our stress impact our eating habits? Like what do you notice on your side of things with the people that you consult with or through your groups?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have I have something called the, you know, the wheel of change, which is again, it's not my theory. It's just an explanation on well-known behavioral change theories. And you know, people will refer to themselves as falling off the wagon. I'm sure everyone knows that idea that you've been doing something, you know, that's perhaps healthful and maybe it's changing your eating or maybe it's going for a walk or it's doing something. And when you stop it, it's referred to as falling off the wagon. So the things that are most likely to cause that to happen are, you know, stress and distress. And we often look at, I mean, stress technically is a physiological response in the body that is normal to an external stressor. So people fear stress, but it's normal. Like if we had no stress response ever, then we would be dead. So that's not helpful. So we
No.
do need, like everything, like lots of things, it is a Goldilocks effect. You don't want too much and you don't want too little. You want just the right amount. But the key is, well, there's a couple of keys. One, I think, is that in our modern society, and particularly, and this is generalization, but it is often the mother, the woman, who is like the linchpin of the family. She's the one who's potentially working, also takes on the cognitive load of shopping, of organizing, you know, kids' dental appointments, who's doing what after school activity. So she takes on a lot. She has a caring role. It's very nurturing. She's looking after the kids, potentially the partner, the parents, the dog. A lot. There's all this stuff constantly on her mind, and rarely does she take time to stop and rest. And when she does, she feels guilty and lazy. But the thing is, we know in the stress response that that's what it's meant to do. You're meant to have a response, and then it's meant to end, and you rest, which is exactly what happens when you think about nature. And interestingly, it's the female lions that do the hunting. So they're off, they're hunting, they've got a big stress response. They're running, 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 running. They grab the thing and then they lie down for half a day and rest. So we don't do that. So that means we're constantly got this, cortisol load going, which is unhelpful for our health long term. It's inflammatory. It increases our increases the imbalance in our metabolic hormones, which is, one of the drivers of chronic disease, and in particular obesity, is insulin resistance, driven a lot by chronic stress. So, so there's that as one aspect. And then because we become in this sort of crazy busy life, we're actually not particularly efficient in the way we do things. We're tired, we're looking for relief from this feeling. And, a couple of places to get that relief are, food, quickly shoveling in a chocolate bar, or in recent years, phone scrolling. And you've got all these things to do, but you just need a little time out, so you play 10,000 games at Candy Crush.
I like what you were saying about the stress cycle, because that's something I talk to clients about, is we need to complete the cycle, and we don't, people don't know that. And sometimes I'll draw a very simple, the I think it's the Yerkes-Dodson law, like a little bell curve on a whiteboard, and show people that we need some stress to get to peak performance. And then too much stress, we start to lose our capacity to engage in those tasks meaningfully. And if you sit at that end of that pointy end of the bell curve for long enough is when you develop those chronic health conditions, regardless of the quality of your diet. So you could be doing and having an amazing diet, but it's stress that'll kill you.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And again, it's, it feels hard sometimes, like, oh my God, I've got to do all these things. I've got to sleep well. I've got to manage my stress. I've got to do some movement. I've got to eat properly. Like, it feels like a full-time job. However, when you create that bit of space by completing the stress cycle, which is often literally the resting, you become much more efficient. You then have time. And, we always say to people, you don't have to do everything in the first day. Like, you suddenly decide, and this particularly, this time of year, we're recording this in New Year, that's what people do. They write this great big list of all the things they're going to do because they want to feel better. And they try and do them all at once, and then, again, something, life gets busy, and they stop doing, they stop them, and that then is the, oh, I've fallen off the wagon.
Yeah, so I'll ask you in a moment about mindful eating, but when we're looking at stressful periods, are there any specific sort of nutritional considerations? So if someone knows they've got a particularly stressful time coming up, or deadlines at work, or maybe it's term three and all the kids have got grand finals and so on. Like, there's just a patch of time that's going to be difficult. Are there any things that they should consider consuming less of or more of, or things to help that process along?
So a couple of things. I mean, often when we're stressed, we do the things that are the least helpful to us. So that can be suddenly, drinking a lot more coffee, for example. Now, don't get me wrong, I love myself a good cup of coffee. I'm very happy to have coffee. I have two coffees a day, but I know if I was stressed because I don't sleep well and I'm tired and I need to power through the day, it's tempting to increase that coffee and have, four or five coffees. But the thing is that the coffee increases your, again, it's a stimulant, so it increases your adrenaline and your cortisol, which is what's already overactive in your body. So whilst it's tempting, it's not actually that helpful. The other thing we then do is at the end of the day, we go, oh, I'm going to wind down. I'm so stressed. I'm just going to wind down. I just want to have a glass of wine. And so you have a glass of wine or two, and then that actually impairs your sleep, sorry. And the other thing we'll sometimes do is not go to bed because, if you're a busy person, busy mum, the time at the end of the day, everyone's in bed, the kids are asleep, the kitchen's cleaned, you sit down, you think, oh, thank God, this is my time. And then you don't want to go to bed because the minute you go to bed, the next thing that your conscious brain is aware of is that you're starting the whole rat race again. And so we try and eke out that time to yourself for as long as possible. And we do it by stealing sleep. And so you then start your day behind the eight ball, you're sleep deprived, and it all starts again. And you just end up in this cycle. So I always say to people, well, look, the thing that we really need to do in busy, busy times is prioritize our sleep. If we can go to bed early, Doesn't have to be early, but earlier, then we set ourselves up the next day. And a little kind of hack I have is, because I used to go, oh, I don't want to get out of bed. Then I'd have this weird conversation about how I don't want to go to bed, but then once I'm in, I don't want to get out of bed. And what I realized is it's not the bed, it's the things we're just saying. So now I call bed my rejuvenation palace. And I'm going, and I imagine it's like a day spa, and I'm off to rejuvenate, and I'm repairing my cells, and I'm replenishing and restoring all the things that I need for my busy day. And it's life-changing and it's free. So yeah, so that's helpful.
It makes me think, as you're describing that, I can picture if I've gone interstate for a conference or something, that's when I seem to do all of those things. Like I'm out of routine, my gym's not nearby. I might have packed runners, but I'm like, oh, it feels like the novelty of being somewhere new. So I might sleep in. Then I have a coffee at the hotel. I might get a second coffee at the conference. There's usually some delicious treat that I might have as morning tea and then lunch and then afternoon tea. And before I know it, I've eaten a week's worth of, maybe treats in a day. And then I'm digesting all the content. So I might be really tired, but then really energized. So I might have a glass of wine or two. And if you do that for a few days, I can see looking back the impact of those.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there are, lots of us do that. That's how you live your life. And it becomes the new normal. And you almost become disconnected from how your body feels because this is the new normal. It's like, having the hum of an air conditioner in the background, you just block it out. And it's not until you stop and sort of give your body and your brain that space that you go, oh my God, I feel so much better. I feel so much better.
Yeah.
And
So
that's, yeah.
if we move into thinking about mindfulness, and it doesn't mean you have to be a, cross-legged yogi doing 30 minutes of meditation, but how do we, if someone knows nothing about it and this just feels really terrifying, how can we explain how to start eating mindfully and noticing your habits and just
Yeah.
the smallest step forward that people can take?
Yeah. So I think, again, what we have become disconnected, our food, where our food comes from, what we're eating, we're completely disconnected from it. And our brain, and again, I love human brain, as I'm sure you do. And our very clever brains are so clever that they're actually looking for shortcuts all the time, which makes sense. I mean, if you're a person, if you're in a jungle and you've got two pathways and one's covered in brambles and prickles and vines and you've got to hack your way through it, and the other one is a lovely mossy carpet, well, of course, you're going to go the mossy carpet route. That's normal. That's smart. What's happened in our world is the way we eat and prepare our food, we're looking for the mossy carpet. So we're looking for the quickest, the shortest, the easiest way to consume our food. But at the end of the mossy carpet, there's actually a big hole, the pit of despair. And one of the things that we get asked a lot is, oh my God, this is so labor intensive, all this cooking. And sometimes what I do is I tell a story about, well, imagine it wasn't that long ago, like a couple of hundred years ago, before we had electricity, people had to go and hunt their own food. So if they're a bit hungry, they'd have to go and hunt a, I don't know, a bison or a deer or something. First of all, spend a few hours tracking it, getting, then hunting it, then getting it. Then they'd have to prepare it. So it'd be having to be skinned. And then because it was this big thing, they'd have to try and, salt some of it for later. And there was all this stuff that was involved. Then, of course, there weren't any matches. So you had to go and get some flint and gather some wood and all of this thing to prepare it so you could then cook it. And all of this took forever. And all we have to do is go to the fridge, get a few eggs out, crack them into a pan. You can make an omelet in about 3 minutes and you're done. And that seems so much easier in comparison to all of the other things. So, because we're all looking down the, for the mossy road, the easy path, and advertising again gets in there, it's convinced us that not only do we not have time to prepare any food, we don't even have time to eat it. and enter up and go. And so people are now believing that they don't have time to eat. They need a shake or some sort of pre-prepared drink as their meal, and that that's somehow going to help them. And honestly, it just doesn't. It is so far away from what humans are supposed to consume. And so, particularly if people are thinking about weight loss, they go to a weight loss shake. And that's like the opposite of what we should be doing. And instead, if we go to the food and we get rid of as much processed products as possible, and a little line I love is that processed food steals the joy of real food. And you don't have to wait very long for your body and brain to recalibrate. But when you get back to real whole food, so that's food as close in nature as it's meant to be with minimal processing, your taste buds become alive. And so you can taste the food. And you can taste the individual, almost the individual ingredients in it. And I remember once really savoring a Thai green chicken curry. Which, I used to eat, but because I had a lot of sugar and a lot of processed food, this was just another bit of food. And then once I got all rid of all that stuff, there was a time where I'm eating this and I'm going, oh my God, I can actually taste the lime. I can taste the ginger. I can taste the lemongrass. And it was like this amazing experience. And I never believed it when people used to talk about that. Like I'm thinking, oh God, I don't know what you're talking about. I think you're making it up. I think you're just a foodie. And I'm not a foodie, but when you get rid of the processed food, your taste buds come alive. So then, as part of mindfulness, it's really just noticing mindfulness is noticing first, noticing, not judging, just noticing, noticing. Oh, isn't it interesting? Every afternoon, I go and stand in my cupboard and look. And you think, what am I looking for? What am I needing? What am I wanting? What does my brain want? Is it actually hungry? Often not. It's bored. It's looking for some entertainment. Just had a difficult phone call. So that you can start to observe and collate why you eat. And recognizing that hunger, physiological hunger, and then psychological drivers to eat are actually completely separate processes. But we often don't know that. And we often haven't been taught that. And we often don't even realize. So we think we're hungry when we're not physiologically hungry. And so then people start, because again, of dieting, they start getting scared of hunger and they're hungry and they don't know what to do. And they're actually properly physiologically hungry, which is your body saying, we need some fuel, we need some nutrition, we need some sustenance. And we're so disconnected, we don't know what to do.
You mentioned, I mean, I'm pulling out the feelings that I can see in those situations, but there's boredom, stress, overwhelm, even just looking for fun or novelty, which I guess might be boredom. But so it sounds
Yeah.
like maybe the first step, you don't might not even have to change anything just yet, is actually starting to notice where you're at when you're making those choices, or even just sort of reflecting on your behavior throughout a day. Like, how would someone just start small?
Yeah, so most people, if they've, I get one of our, to bring it back to basics, our philosophy at Real Life Medicine is to you empower people. So basically, they can make choices that they're happy and comfortable and that they can live a life of no regrets. And I think for a lot of people, food holds regrets for all sorts of reasons. And again, whether it's dieting, whether, diet language is all about cheating and breaking and, being weak and all of those things. So recognizing, so when we do that, let's say we go on a bit of a bender and eat a whole pile of stuff, we feel terrible about ourselves, especially if we made this promise not to do it. So we feel so terrible that we then don't want to know about it. We just sort of bury it away. Nobody, you don't examine it. You just pretend it didn't happen. Whereas I like to say, we use a little acronym, which is SLC, which is to self-reflect. So you just look at it and you learn and you do it with compassion. Because at the end of the day, your brain's trying to do two things. It's trying to keep you safe and make you feel better. So keeping us safe is obviously if we're physiologically starving, well, it's going to tell you to eat. It's normal. If we were trying to feel better because we've had a crap day because, we ran over the cat or our boss came in and yelled at us or whatever, these are just tools that our brain is offering to make you feel better. You haven't murdered anyone. You haven't ripped off old ladies. You haven't done some Ponzi internet scam where you're stealing, the retirement funds of people who have hard worked. You haven't done any of that. All you've done is used a tool that at one stage served you well and perhaps no longer does. So yeah, I think you can start, and you can even just write it down. And there's a little acronym that's not my acronym, although we always like to, it's like recipes, I fiddle a bit. So there's an acronym that is the HALT acronym for why people, this is for addiction, why people perhaps drink. And we've put a P in front of it. So we use the FALT acronym. So it's people will eat or drink because they've either got pain, because they're hungry. And by that I mean physiologically hungry. They're angry, they're lonely, or they're tired. So the angry can be, angry doesn't have to just be anger. It can be resentment. Like resentment is a big driver to eat because it's an awful feeling when you've said yes to doing something and you wish you weren't doing it, but you don't have the confidence or the ability to say no. So you just see the way being, grumpy about it. And how do we fix that? We eat. Lonely can be physically lonely, but it can also be lonely in that maybe you feel you're bearing the burden of responsibility, for example. You don't feel anyone sharing that with you. So you're taking it all on. So it feels lonely doing that. And tiredness is two things. Tiredness physiologically, if you're tired, if you're not getting enough sleep, does affect your metabolic drivers to eat. So it's normal. It's a normal physiological response. But also we're often looking for dopamine driving processed food as a little pick me up to kind of feel better. Because most people, when they're tired, aren't sitting down to a bowl of broccoli to give them some energy. They end up drinking or eating some, again, usually processed food bar.
I was just quickly scribbling that down because that's such a really good acronym. And I think one of the things I've noticed when people try to do diets is they're just trying to focus on substitution instead of actually thinking. It's just like, oh, just grab some hummus and carrots. It's like what you're talking about is notice the why. Get to know, am I lonely? Am I sad? Am I overwhelmed? Am I tired? Am I hurt? And starting to recognize those drivers, that's the first step. Because that behavior
Absolutely.
change can't come without awareness, and substitution merely won't work.
No, and that's what diets are short-term substitutions where people go, oh good, I know, they go, oh, good, I know what to do, I'll just follow this plan. Usually they involve some calorie restriction, and so the allure is that short-term most of them will work, but I don't know anyone who's happy to lose 5 kilos only to put 7 on. And that's what diet, like it's not just me making that up, that's the science, that calorie restriction without attention to, your physiological drivers, your understanding, your psychology. And look, I mean, the clearest thing to me is the fact that about 30% of our clients have had gastric sleeve surgery or gastric bypass surgery. So invasive surgical operations in an attempt to improve their metabolic health and prevent chronic disease. But if you never understand why you're eating in the first place, again, our clever brain comes up with all sorts of tricks to continue to use food to soothe. And it's only once you get past that, and it doesn't happen overnight. Like it would be great to go, yeah, oh good, I don't use food to soothe anymore. But I can honestly say that as a person who did, who was a very big emotional eater, who ate a lot of processed food, I don't do it anymore, and it's not willpower. I'm not every day wishing I could have my pack of Maltesers. It's changing what I used food for and getting the skills on what to do when I am emotionally distressed. So you can't just take away a tool and not replace it with another tool. And this is, where people like you, Marie, are experts in helping people develop tools to emotionally regulate.
Thank you. So if someone listening, if this something resonates with them, and I'll get you in a moment to share some of the work you're doing, where they can find you. If someone's listening and they're like, okay, so not a big grand New Year's resolution. I don't need to kind of, what's one thing that they could do? If you were to sort of say, okay, here's one takeaway piece, here's a little experiment to try for the day or for the week. What's something that you might encourage people to think about?
So, potentially doing an audit of the processed food intake, because processed food, it's not, and again, it's not that I think people are eating processed food are, they're not greedy, they're not lazy, they're not weak. It's not a moral failing to eat processed food, but what it is recognizing that you've been sold to. And there are people out there who are saying that, the reason processed food is so destructive is because it's high in sugar and high in fat and high in salt. But it's actually more than that. It is more than that because it's the way the food is processed, the fact that it is designed to be overeaten. So, it kills me. I see so many people who are trying hard to improve their health, and not realizing that it's the processing of the food that they're eating that is actually taking them off their path. So, which basically means coming back to things like, well, what is unprocessed food? And so it's looking at ingredients. And in fact, you'll remember this. Do you remember there was a book, crazy popular recipe book called The Four Ingredients or The Five Ingredients or something like that? And when I looked, and I bought it because, who wouldn't want to cook with four or five ingredients? So easy. Except they weren't ingredients. They were, packets of biscuits. That was counted as an ingredient. So an ingredient is the things that are in your fridge, fruit, veggies, a protein. And look, our formula is easy. It's pick a protein. So you have protein as the king of your dish. So your protein is something like meat, fish, chicken, eggs, dairy. If you're vegetarian, it can be tofu, tempeh, can be lentils and things like that. If you're insulin resistant, we haven't talked a lot about that at this stage, but if you are, so that's anyone with diabetes, pre-diabetes, fatty liver disease, high blood pressure, if you're storing all your fat around the middle, you're likely to be insulin resistant. For those people, it is most helpful to have a low carbohydrate version. So it gets a bit tricky then with lentils and chickpeas because they're higher in carbohydrate. So you pick a protein, you add some veggies, whatever veggies you like, again, preferably above ground veggies. If you're insulin resistant, we tend to avoid or minimize our use of below ground veggies. Add some fats, which are things like some avocados, some nuts, some olives, some olive oil, some butter. Things that are just not processed. Like there's one ingredient. There's one ingredient in butter, and that's butter. Oh, sometimes there's two, might have a bit of salt. But there's not 45 ingredients like margarine. And then you add some flavor, which is herbs, spices, a bit of salt. Again, salt's not the enemy. We've been demonizing it. It's not. But you're not adding things with flavors and thickeners and gums and enhancers and all of that because ultimately it's not going to help you. And so that formula is it's sort of easy and it's you can do it any way you like. So you can make, curries like that. You can make, basic steak and veggie, which sounds so boring, but when you add a little bit of butter, because remember, I grew up in diet land where butter was like, anybody who ate butter was committing murder. But you add a bit of butter and a little bit of salt to it, and suddenly green beans taste amazing. So it doesn't have to be complicated, but minimizing the processed food in your diet and your family's diet, if you can, is the key to long-lasting health.
Yeah, I love that. And maybe I was thinking, as you were saying that, I was thinking maybe combining that audit with the P halt that you mentioned, or the fault. So when am I consuming my most processed foods? What's happening for me? Is it pain, hungry, angry, lonely, or tired? And I think that might be a nice place to start. People don't realize, oh, I grab a bag of chips at 5 o'clock because I'm hungry. And waiting from maybe lunch was at 12 and dinner's at 7, maybe that's too long a gap. So starting to reflect on that could be a helpful
Absolutely.
start.
And I think sometimes people don't know if they're hungry or not, like properly hungry. How do I know if I'm hungry? This is a common question. And so we have a thing we call egg hungry. And again, if you eat eggs, you'll know what I mean. Tim Tams. So I do a little story about Tim Tams. So, I was a very big Tim Tam eater. 9 Tim Tams has the same calories as 12 eggs. Now, I can eat 9 Tim Tams without too much trouble sitting down, one after the other. And in fact, there's 11 in the packet, so I'd probably eat 11. And I might feel a bit sick and sort of think, oh God, I'm never eating Tim Tams again. And then probably 3 or 4 hours later, I'd get the shakes and feel a little bit hungry again and want to eat more Tim Tams if there were any more in the house. But if I can't eat 12 eggs. Nobody can. You can't sit down and go, I'm just going to have a little snack of 12 boiled eggs. It's very hard because they are essentially protein with some fat and a whole heap of nutrients. And our body is saying, no, you're done. I don't need any more, Lucy. I don't need any more eggs. I'm done. I'm full. I don't want any. So my thing is always, I will always go, are you egg hungry? So, if you're mooching around, you go, I'm starving. Have a couple of boiled eggs. I don't want eggs. Well, then you're not hungry. So then you think, well, I must. What are the others? Is it pain, lonely, tired, angry, bored? Bored is sort of in there with a bit of lonely, So yeah. And then you just go, okay, well, I don't physically need anything. So therefore, I need to go and find some entertainment somewhere else.
Yeah, I love that. I remember that from the course and I still use that, and I do like eggs, so they're my go-to backup plan of a couple of boiled eggs. And if I'm craving, like, oh, do I really want a chai latte? Am I hungry? Is it a treat? Do I want the taste? Can I eat an egg or a can of tuna? And it just starts to help you kind of think, oh, yeah, no, it's I'm just craving the like deliciousnessness or I don't know, the texture or the taste, so I'm not hungry.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting because I think the craving side of things, like I used to crave, like Maltesers were like my, crack. And I loved them. And I would be looking forward to a day on the couch reading a book with a bag of Maltesers. And then I'd finish the bag and be a bit sad that I didn't have another bag. And I realized actually that my desire for Maltesers was never quenched. It was like a thirst that could never be quenched or an itch that could never be completely scratched. And it didn't matter whether I had 10 Maltesers or 200, I still wanted more. So having small amounts of those actually wasn't satisfying. When people go, just have a little bit, that didn't help me. It didn't soothe or settle anything. And over time, it's now for me much easier. Only on certain products, it's not everything. It's much easier to have none than some. But again, this is where people need to forge their own pathway and work out. It's not for me to say, oh, well, you'll find it easier to have no Maltesers than some. It might not be for you. I can have a couple of chips, for example, and I don't care that much about them. That they're fine. Other people have two hot chips and want to, go into the kitchen at the restaurant and basically shovel in as many as they can. It's working out what works for you. Which is why another one of our favorite sayings is that eating is not a team sport. It's an individual pursuit. And what works for each individual is what works for them. And we don't all have to do the same thing all the time.
Yeah, that's a really lovely thing to think about as we wrap up.
Yeah.
If people want to find out more about how you work and what you do, and I'll include links to any of these in the show notes, but for people listening as they're driving or walking around, where can they find you?
So real life medicine is our thing. Everything, so it's all about real life. So our Instagram is real underscore life underscore medicine. Facebook's real life medicine. Our website is RL medicine. And you just have to Google that and you'll find it. We have, short courses, we have memberships, we support. Our biggest thing, I think, in this day and age, the key to long lasting health and weight loss for people is support, so that they're, again, knowing what to eat's one thing, but why you eat and unpacking that and knowing that it doesn't have to all be done in one day. It's the key.
Great. Thanks so much, Lucy. And I'll get all of those as links in the show notes for people.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me, Marie. And I hope I've been able to provide something helpful and valuable for your listeners.
It has been. Thank you. Thank you for listening. To keep the conversation going, head on over to Instagram or LinkedIn and follow me. If you'd like to keep updated with episodes and other interesting things happening in mental health, join my weekly This Complex Life newsletter, where I'll share tools, tips, and insight. There's a link in the show notes. Got a question you want answered? Shoot me an email or a DM. I'd love to hear from you. And if you enjoy the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could leave a rating and a review. It helps other people find the podcast.